Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by three editors of the new book from Routledge Press, The Wollstonecraftian Mind. This is an amazing and gorgeous book that is part of Routledge's series, The Philosophical Minds. But today, I'm joined by Sandrine Berges, Eileen Hunt Boding, and Alan Coffey. And I'd like to welcome all three of them to the program and ask them to each tell us a little bit about themselves and how they came to this project. And I believe we're going to start with Sandrine.
Thanks, Lily, for inviting us to talk about this. So I'm Sandrine Berges, and I teach philosophy at Gulkent University, which is in Turkey. I've been working on Wollstonecraft not for that long, for about 10 years. And early on in my Wollstonecraft career, I met Alan, I think that was 9 years ago, in a conference in Lund. And we've been working together since. And just when we did, so I'm going to tell you how we came to work on that project. Just when we were finishing one project, a volume on Wollstonecraft, social and political philosophy for OUP, I got a message from Rebecca from Routledge saying, we've got this new series and I'd really like to have a woman on it, The Philosophical Minds, and I think Wollstonecraft would be great. Would you be interested in working on it, perhaps with someone else? So I asked Alan, and he said, yep, that sounds like a great project. And it was a big project, so we wanted a third person. And we both worked before with Eileen, and we really liked her, and her background was really complementary to ours as well. So we asked her, and she said yes, and there you go. It's been a great collaboration, not just a book, but also we've done some mini-conferences. We've created a Wollstonecraft Society, and of course, we're all friends as well. So that's my story.
Alan?
Okay, yes. Well, I'm Alan Coffey, as Sandrine said. I teach global ethics and human values at King's College in London. And like Sandrine, I hadn't been working on Wollstonecraft for very long. I'm a political philosopher, really. So I came at the subject as a contemporary political philosopher, and I work in sort of Republican theory, which is a particular kind of social and political theory based around an idea of freedom. And it was just a chance conversation, because I was sort of unsatisfied with the contemporary way that things were done, and the husband of my then or previous PhD supervisor, Quentin Skinner, is an expert on Republican theory. And he just mentioned in passing, he just said, oh, by the way, you might find Wollstonecraft quite interesting. She mentions the language of slavery and domination, which is a key theme for Republicans. And then he said no more about it. No one had really taken that idea particularly seriously. But when I had a look at it, I'm not saying I sort of pioneered this. There are many other people. Lena Haldanius, one of our sort of collaborators as well, had already done quite a lot on this. But in terms of Republicans themselves, no one really took Wollstonecraft seriously as a contemporary political theorist in her own right, outside of gender studies, maybe history of early feminism, and so on. And this was just a revelation to me, that here was someone working on exactly the kind of questions that I was doing now in a contemporary context that I'd barely heard of, certainly not in this context. And Lena Haldenius organized a conference, as Sandrine said, in Lund, in Sweden. And that's where we all met. And out of that conference, there was a follow-up at Birkbeck in London. And that was where we had the idea for just a small volume on the social and political philosophy of Mary Wollstonecraft. Just to push the ideas, we've got sort of experts from different fields of Wollstonecraft scholarship, just to sort of push the idea that she's a serious philosopher, political theorist in her own right, which now is widely accepted. But at the time, I'm going to say at the time, this seemed quite unusual. That's because that was the way it appeared to us. The more we probe, the more we find out that in Germany there were people working on this in the 90s and other sort of non-Anglophone countries, that people going back to the 80s and 70s. So nothing, I think, is entirely new. But certainly in the circles that we mixed in, this seemed quite an unusual thing. As I say, that was a small volume, and Eileen had contributed a wonderful article on children's rights into that book. So it seemed like the obvious when Sandrine had been approached about setting this one up, it just seemed the obvious choice of someone. And plus, Eileen knows so many more people than we do as well. It's just a 40-chapter book, and I think without her contacts and networks, we would have been stumped. So I think I'll hand over to Eileen at that point.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you. Yes, the legacies chapter, or the interlocutors chapter, and the philosophy section of this book are two of my favorites. I think what the interlocutors section accomplishes is to show that Wollstonecraft pioneered a innovative style of doing philosophy, in that she was interested in engaging fellow political thinkers, especially those from the 18th century, in a critical dialogue about key terms and ideas in political thought that hadn't previously been engaged from what today we'd call a feminist perspective. And so she engaged in a critical philosophical dialogue with thinkers like Rousseau and Burke and Immanuel Kant, in a way that generated an entirely new style of doing feminist political theory. And this is why, to the present day, we often look back upon Wollstonecraft as the beginning of modern feminist political thought. And this style of doing philosophy influenced later thinkers, especially those who were concerned with questions of women's rights and women's subjugation under patriarchy. And the interlocutor section in particular, and also the Wollstonecraftian philosophy section after it, chart how Wollstonecraft was a philosophical, literary, and political source for some of the leading theorists of women's rights and feminism in the modern tradition. And we trace that out from Catherine McCullough all the way to Simone de Beauvoir, Laurie Marceau, a political theorist who has written an excellent recent book on Simone de Beauvoir's political thought, did the chapter on de Beauvoir for this volume. And she did a nice job showing the ways that even though de Beauvoir only references Wollstonecraft, I believe, just briefly twice in The Second Sex, The philosophical engagement is much deeper than that seemingly superficial reference to her as part of an early list of women who advocated for equal rights for the sexes. De Beauvoir, in fact, can be read, Marzo argues, as engaging not only Wollstonecraft's ideas about womanhood, but also her daughter, Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein, her conceptions of womanhood and monstrosity and otherness that come out in the greatest feminist gothic novel of the 19th century.
This is an amazing book. And as you are all talking about it, in terms of coming at it from different to some degree, slightly different disciplinary perspectives, and also training and exposure to Wollstonecraft before we get into the book itself. And I would like to go through the sections of the book. I would love for you to talk about, as you've sort of started to discuss, Wollstonecraft as a political theorist, as a philosopher, which is really what the book is doing in terms of getting at her work and the people with whom she interacted, and also the sort of legacy of her work. But you've mentioned this a couple of times, and so for listeners, to talk about the fact that she needed to be, quote, recovered. And Eileen, you just noted that at the time of her initial writing, she was considered to be a political theorist. But to some degree, what happened? And so, Alan, you had mentioned that there were a lot of people in Europe, non-Anglophone countries, doing work on her. So I'd love for you each to talk a little bit about where her thinking sort of fits within our understanding of political theory, in particular, philosophy in general.
I think really this is a question for both Alan, who's done a lot of work on republicanism, and for Eileen, who's the real political theorist here. I just want to say that in terms of recovery, what Alan said earlier, it's quite true that in philosophy, it was very difficult to find anyone working on Wollstonecraft, at least in the UK when I was studying. And she was considered, sometimes you could find her works in political theory sections of libraries and bookshops. But once I went to Oxford and asked in the main bookshop there, I can't remember what it's called, Blackwell perhaps, asked them where Wollstonecraft was, where I could find her. And they said, I think you can find her book in the travel section. That was in 2011, I think. So there's been a lot of change. I mean, a lot of recovery has been happening, and now you can actually buy philosophy books on Wollstonecraft and find them in philosophy section. But as I say, I think Alan and Eileen have probably more to say, so I'll pass this on to Alan.
I think I'm going to pass a lot of that over to Eileen. I think we might go around in circles a little on that. But I can say how it appears to me from the perspective I take. And as you say, Wollstonecraft was prominent, certainly in her time, perhaps notorious, certainly controversial. She wrote, before she wrote the Vindication of the Rights of Woman that we all celebrate and know, she'd written a very sort of high-profile Vindication of the Rights of Men in answer to Edmund Burke. So this was an intervention in a big debate. Burke himself was writing about the French Revolution, in very critical terms, and he had particularly singled out, or the catalyst for what he wrote was a sermon given by Richard Price, a prominent dissenting minister, a very fine philosopher, also now largely forgotten as it happens. He attacked him in very sort of scathing terms. So Wollstonecraft, she was the first to reply. I think she gets a little bit, you know, too much credit for that. She was the first to reply, and it was remarkably quick in the time she'd written. The second to reply was Catherine Macaulay, wrote an equally fine response, and it really was only a few weeks later. People seem to focus on her being the first, but nevertheless, I mean, she was ahead of Thomas Paine and all this, so she sort of announced herself in very prominent terms, and she was gathering her skills and reputation as she reviewed for a sort of intellectual magazine at the time, and she was reading very widely, writing very forthright reviews. I think, as Eileen will point out, I mean, her writing was received in far-flung parts of the world. So she had a reputation. I wouldn't say she was, you know, a superstar, but she certainly had a reputation. Now, the reason why she's been forgotten by the discipline, I think, has a number of strands to it, and I don't think they're all to do with sexism. A lot of them are. The way we can conceive our sort of canon of who we go to and who we don't was constructed, I think, in this much more in the 19th, 20th century. People had lost their moorings of who had been influential in the time, and we're now looking back and picking out the key male figures. So there's clear sexism there, but there was another reason I think she was forgotten, certainly as a political theorist, maybe not as a feminist, and that was because she was so radical. So the 1790s, this was the French Revolution time, and Wollstonecraft was sort of in favour. She was very much a revolutionary, albeit of a sort of moderate kind. And revolutionary radical ideas became very unpopular. This was the 1790s. This was the chaos and terror in France, and we had the Napoleonic sort of wars. And so in Britain, became very reactionary. Price was another victim of this. So it wasn't Joseph Priestley was another one. So it wasn't just, and these are big figures in America, but forgotten certainly in England. Catherine McCauley, another. So in terms of her contribution to the discipline of political philosophy, I think it was really that she had not been rediscovered by that audience when later canons were developed. And even when it came to the 70s and 80s and feminist scholars, political theorists were sort of pioneering the recovery, there was another problem, which was that in order to understand Wollstonecraft fully, you can't just come to her text as if it was written today. You have to understand the time, and you have to sort of appreciate the frameworks that she's using. And in the 70s and 80s, even 90s, she was considered to be a liberal theorist. This was the sort of main philosophical, political tradition that we understood as being present at that time. And so we read her back as a liberal. And that coloured a lot of feminists against her, because this was a time when liberal theory was being attacked for its patriarchy and its sort of gender biases by feminists. And she seemed to be an inadequate liberal and an inadequate feminist. So this caused some problems in how to understand her. It was only, I think, a little bit later, when modern contemporary political theorists began to understand this republican idea that I've mentioned a couple of times, which is a particular kind of idea that was very, very prominent in Wollstonecraft's time. It was used in the founding documents and the revolution of America and in France. And this idea of a free citizen in a free state amongst other sort of free citizens, not ruled by a king, not ruled arbitrarily by the whim of a despotic master, but a self-governing community of equals. And once you start to see Wollstonecraft as writing in that genre, a lot of her distinctive philosophical contribution, not just her forthright feminism, but actually quite subtle analysis about the way that gender norms can distort public reason and lead to exclusion in very sort of subtle ways, that all became much clearer. So I think it's only been quite recently that contemporary thinkers have been in a position fully to understand, or at least to approach her work in more favourable ways. And so she's very rapidly taken on a prominence now in that particular field, Republican political theory, which is itself growing as a political ideal. So it's just one narrow area of political philosophy, but it's a very concrete and discrete one, and it's given her a platform in order to be appreciated more widely.
My own perspective is that without the two of you, this book never would have happened because of your networks, your extensive networks in philosophy in particular, which, as both of you point out, had really been kind of behind the curve in recovering Wollstonecraft for ethics and political philosophy. Political science, interestingly, maybe for the first time, was ahead of the curve because one of the leading scholars of women in politics and the history of political thought in our discipline, Virginia Shapiro, who contributed to the Wollstonecraftian Mind, a wonderful new chapter on Wollstonecraft's conception of virtue. Shapiro had published one of the leading works on Wollstonecraft back in 1992, A Vindication of Political Virtue, The Political Theory of Mary Wollstonecraft. And so in political science, interestingly, a field that's not exactly known for being particularly friendly to questions of gender and women and feminism, actually led the way in part because there were pioneering scholars like Shapiro way back in the 1980s and early 90s who were kind of pushing the envelope and getting Wollstonecraft into the canon again. Because as we know, Wollstonecraft was basically famous in her own time in the 1790s, as soon as she published her early works. And so our task has been to get her back where she originally was very early in her career, a very well-known, high-profile political theorist and advocate of women's rights. The question of how I got back to how I arrived at Wollstonecraft and the study of Wollstonecraft goes back to my time as a student in the 1990s at Cambridge and Yale. I was at Cambridge for 2 years after college, and I had the opportunity to take tutorials and attend lectures with Silvana Tomaselli, one of the leading Wollstonecraft scholars in the world, who's edited the Cambridge edition of Wollstonecraft's Two Vindications, a very important text in her field. And then I went to Yale, and I was able to write my dissertation on Wollstonecraft, Burke, and Rousseau's theories of the egalitarian transformation of the family during their time. And that became my first book, published by SUNY Press in 2006. And since then, I've published a series of other books that are on Wollstonecraft, including the Yale edition of her Vindication of the Rights of Woman, which came out in 2014. I came to this project entirely because of the generosity of Sandrine and Alan, and their reaching out to me as a scholar in political science and asking me to be part of this first philosophical consortium on Mary Wollstonecraft's thought.
I wanted to ask the two of you then to sort of take us through a little bit of the structure of the book itself, which again, sort of not only is about Mary Wollstonecraft as a theorist, but also has a number of other dynamics to it in terms of thinking about her work, but also the people with whom she was interacting and responding to. And so in terms of the layout of the book, I believe it has five sections. And they, you know, they sort of go through Mary Wollstonecraft's, her background, her major works, her interlocutors, her own philosophy, and of course the legacy that she left. So I would love for one of you to sort of start us out a little bit with regard to her background, which I understand also from my reading of this book was interesting in terms of her education.
Yes. So thank you. I was mostly responsible for the background section. First, generally, about the sections that we've got, we had a model to work with, or a couple of models. We had the Rousseauian mind and the Kantian mind. And so we used that to try and decide how to break things down. But at the same time, with the understanding that Wollstonecraft was not the same kind of philosopher as Rousseau. She didn't have access to the same books, for instance, and or to the same kind of education. And that's something that's really reflected in the background section, because we had to make some hard choices about what to include and what not to include. And one thing that we went back and forth on quite a lot, in particular, was the missing first chapter. There's nothing there about Plato and Aristotle. So the reason we went back and forth a lot on that, and it might seem odd that I'm talking about a non-existent chapter here, but I think it's quite an important non-existent chapter, and the reason it doesn't exist is also quite important. We thought there ought to be one, probably because we do think that some of what she says is influenced by both Plato and Aristotle, but the problem is that we don't think she'd read very much Plato or Aristotle, and it's kind of hard to be influenced by someone you haven't read. So she knew people who had, like, for instance, Price was a Platonist. So he knew Plato. She talked with him. She would have heard about it. But most of the translations were done the year after her death. So that is a little bit odd to think of Plato as a background to her thinking, but still it is a bit. So we moved on to other, to later philosophers, and especially we've got two chapters on early modern women philosophers and Renaissance women philosophers because we wanted to see how she fitted in that tradition. Because it's quite important when we talk about women philosophers or women political theorists in history that we don't always say, oh, look, she's the first one. No one's ever thought about these things before. She's the only woman in her time to have been doing this kind of work. And we wanted to say, well, that's not the case. You know, there's a tradition of women talking about political theory. And so we're talking about them here in these chapters. And the other challenge we had in the background section was to showcase the right kind of social and political background, which was really, really important for her. So there was, you know, the French Revolution, for instance, and the Enlightenment period. And we had to make sure that this came across to the reader as something that helped shape her thought, but also something that we need to know a little bit about in order to understand what she's talking about. So in particular, her republicanism was very much informed by what was going on in the French Revolution. And then, so it was a matter of striking the right balance, not too much history, especially as it's not, as many people don't really know the history of that period. And I think that's a problem with the political thought and the philosophy of that period as well. It's a bit too late to be early modern, and it's a bit too early to be 19th century. And then, so it kind of gets missed out. People don't really know what's going on there. So we had to make some choices and try to include the right kind of things. And I hope we succeeded. And Alan, do you want to add something about this section?
Well, I think there's possibly the rational dissenters, which is tied in with her republicanism. So her republican ideals, they draw from the period. They draw from the American Revolution. They draw from a number of sources, Rousseau as well. But one particular source was the rational dissenters, these non-conformist Presbyterian sort of ministers who were very much marginalised and sort of persecuted in Britain. They didn't have full civil rights. They couldn't hold office. They were foreclosed certain sort of professions. They would be excluded from the university system, for example. So they were very much outsiders. And they were normally champions of liberty in all its forms. So they championed the American Revolution, I think very famously. Price was a big sort of influence there, Joseph Priestley as well. But they bring their religious views very much into their work. They supported abolition as well, and early feminism, although I think that took a while to get going, and it was people like Wollstonecraft, Macaulay, Anna Barbauld, a few of these sort of pushed it in the UK and in England, and it would be the same in America and France, other women would be pushing that, but this combination of religion, which had a sort of millenarian sort of feel, they very much were looking forward to a utopia when human beings would become rational and moral and virtuous, and the old prejudices would fall away, and with it despotic rule, and so they had a sort of very much a sort of religious vision, but a rationalistic one as well, and Wollstonecraft fits, I think very soundly within that. Price was her big mentor. That we see a break. I mean, I'm going to slightly talk now, I suppose, about the next section, which is her major works. But alongside the Vindication of the Rights of Woman, she's written a lot, and those are not very well discussed. But there is a break, I think, between her early work. She wrote something on the education of daughters. She put together a female reader for educating young girls and various things. And we can see her early philosophy emerging in that. But really, there's a sharp break when she writes The Vindication of the Rights of Men and Woman. And that coincides, is, as I think, quite clearly sort of influenced by her meeting with the rational dissenters. So they're a big part of her philosophy. So that's just one extra chapter there. Shall I move on to the major works?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to sort of for you to both talk about the works themselves and how they help us to understand her as a thinker, the linking together of the work, as well as, you know, sort of what each work individually can speak to.
Well, the chapters then are The Vindication of the Rights of Men. This was this early intervention against Burke, and that really is written in the context of the French Revolution. But that is a very sort of political piece. It's written in terms of, it's a very good piece of political philosophy. We can talk about rights, we talk about liberty, we talk about freedom and slavery, hierarchy, the corruption of virtue. These kind of general political ideas come through very, very clearly in that. But it's a sketchy work, very hurriedly written for a particular purpose. Then there's The Vindication of the Rights of Woman, the one book that everyone's heard of, where she puts out her case for women as equal citizens. The word rights is in the title. It doesn't sort of overtly talk about rights, but they're very much part of the philosophical sort of background of what she's talking about. She's talking about equality, independence, and independence means you're a citizen of equal standing, equal protection under law, equal representation within the law. That's also an idea she started in The Rights of Men, but sort of pursues in this book. So you've got rights, but you've also got this kind of gendered perspective, where she unpicks the kind of background of patriarchy, how effectively gender biases and the way we think skew our ability to reason and deliberate and understand women as equals. So even if women had rights, they would be of no use to women. They would be unenforceable until we can remake the gender relations between men and women, because it's the social prejudices that are so much more powerful than the legal exclusions themselves. The legal exclusions and the lack of rights are just manifestations of how women are actually conceived of. And we've got to attack that first. So this is sort of groundbreaking stuff. She also wrote a couple of novels. She wrote a novel at the very start of her career titled Mary, and one an unfinished novel, Maria or Mariah, I think in the 18th century, but Maria, or The Wrongs of Woman. And it takes on the themes in the Rights of Woman, but sets them in a novelistic context. Her thought has sort of moved on by then, but it very much is a sort of philosophical. I think if Eileen were here, she would announce this as, I think she's just joining us now, but Eileen might announce this as the first philosophical feminist novel. I am not an expert in this to know. But that's what I've heard Eileen say. So this is an important book, unfinished. There's a couple of endings. It's much discussed. It brings to life a lot of what she says in The Vindication of the Rights of Woman, but sets it in a very stark and troubling context. So these are her novels. Again, until recently, they weren't widely discussed outside of English literature circles. So I think this was important. And she has her educational works. There are these early works where she talks about the education of girls in particular. She wrote some original stories, as well as the other two, The Female Reader and The Thoughts on the Education of Daughters. So that's really her main sort of corpus as a travel writer, which seems to be one of her main claims to fame. And I think, and yet another first for Wollstonecraft is that in some context or in some way, her writings of an adventure that she went on at the behest of her then partner, common law husband, however we want to describe it, Gilbert Imlay, she went around Scandinavia. From Germany through Norway, Sweden, and Denmark and Sweden. Amongst other things, and that's a remarkable book, but remarkable in its own right, amongst other things, I've read that it's the first of a certain genre of travel writing as well. So she's chalking up a lot of innovative firsts here. She wrote a moral and, a history of the French Revolution. Again, people say, well, as history itself, it's a bit derivative, but there's a lot of important philosophy in there. It's actually a very, very detailed and important work. And she wrote a lot of letters. So this is the part two, the major works. It looks like we don't have Eileen anymore. The interlocutors, I think I'll pass back to Sandrine for interlocutors, but one of the questions, Lily, that you asked is what surprised us? And the extent of engagement that she had, not directly, but what she was drawing on, what followed her, who drew on her, as well as the depth and breadth of the debates that were going on, not just by Wollstonecraft itself, but women forming their own networks and in their own time. This was a revelation to me, and I think it's something Sandrine speaks very well about, so I'll hand over.
Sandrine, would you like to take us through some of this discussion? This is really a centerpiece of the book in terms of thinking about Wollstonecraft's interlocutors as you sort of craft this section. So if you would like to take up some of that discussion, that would be great.
Yeah, yes, I'll get started. And then I see Eileen's back so she can come in as well. So this section was actually born out of two sections because, as you may have noticed, a bunch of these people were before Wollstonecraft, and a bunch of them were quite a long time after Wollstonecraft. Like Simone de Beauvoir did not ever talk with Wollstonecraft, for instance, nor did Virginia Woolf. But we wanted to give a sense not just of the people who influenced her, the people she had actual exchanges with, but the people who went back and looked at her work or had her work in mind when they created their own. And then one example of that is, of course, Jane Austen. We have no real evidence that she read Wollstonecraft, but it seems very much, and I think Madeleine Cronin, who does a chapter 17, makes a very good case for showing that there is a Wollstonecraftian influence in the works of Jane Austen. So that was an important chapter. And then the same with Harriet Taylor Mill by Helen McCabe. There was definitely some, I mean, we knew she had a copy of Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Woman. She doesn't mention it in her own works, but again, it's very hard not to see the influence there. The chapter I worked with most closely was the one on Rousseau by Christopher Brooke. And Rousseau's influence on Wollstonecraft is very well documented by Wollstonecraft herself. She writes about him in early letters when she starts to develop her own philosophy in writing. She writes to her sister about reading Émile and how influential that is. She reviewed Rousseau's work. She reviewed, I think, the Promenades of the Solitary Dreamer for the analytical review. And she has a huge section on Rousseau in chapter 5 of The Vindication of the Rights of Woman. Now she's got a love-hate relationship with Rousseau, and then she told her husband, as Alan called him, and I think that's accurate, actually, Gilbert Imlay, she wrote to him saying that she was half in love with Rousseau. And the half that was in love was really admiring not only of his writing, but also his educational ideals, the ones that that meant that he left it up to children to educate themselves. There would be no impositions or strict rules. The children really had to go out, really outside in nature and discover the world for themselves, and everything else would follow, according to Rousseau. And she really liked that, except that for Rousseau, of course, this only applied to little boys, and she wanted the same thing to apply to little girls. So chapter 5 of The Vindication of the Rights of Woman, the section on Rousseau, is really arguing point by point against everything that Rousseau's ever said about women. And it is very systematic, and it is very satisfying, I think. And maybe I want to pass this on to Eileen now.
And so I wanted to then take you, or ask you, the three of you, to talk about the last two sections titled Philosophy and Legacies. And the legacy section, I was really intrigued to read through, in part because of the sort of many different dynamics and discussions that are going on in terms of the long shadow of Wollstonecraft. But also I wanted to sort of have you talk a little bit about the section on philosophy, which is distinct from, of course, the works themselves. So Sandrine, if you'd like to start us.
Okay, yes. So the section on philosophy, what we wanted to do there was to get philosophers to pick out particular philosophical themes or questions in Wollstonecraft, and I'm sure how she engaged with it and how you can engage with her as well. So, for instance, Martina Reuter's Reason, Imagination, and Passion. So that's really picking out three concepts that are very important in 18th century philosophy, but also even in 17th century philosophy. Reason and passion are the two ways in which philosophers try to describe the human mind's engagement with the world. And the imagination is perhaps something that's a bit more specific to Wollstonecraft. And I think it's important that Sir Martina brings that out really well, the way in which it's not just a debate between the reason, on the one hand, that's very cold and very sensible, and the passions that carry you to do things that you might regret. It's also the imagination is a way of linking between the two and of using the passions in order to direct reason a little bit better. And that's really fascinating. Another one is the chapter on virtue by Virginia Sapiro. So we could not ask Virginia to do that chapter because she's written a book about it, a book that was really influential and one of the early texts, I think, in political theory and political philosophy to alert us to the existence of Wollstonecraft as a thinker that we had to engage with. And then there's a chapter on theology and religion as well, which I think it was really important to have because very often people think of Wollstonecraft because she was a Republican, because of her sympathies with the French Revolution, they think of her as an atheist. And she definitely wasn't. And this is to the point where I was actually asked to contribute to a volume on atheism, a chapter on Wollstonecraft. I did, but I warned the editor, look, she was not an atheist. So I can write about, you know, which aspect of her thoughts led people to think she was an atheist, but she definitely wasn't. So we wanted to have this chapter in there for that reason. Maybe I can move on to Alan here.
Yes, okay. So the having the section on philosophy itself, I think it is important for Wollstonecraft because so often we package everything about her in terms of what she says about women. And here we get fine professional philosophers to examine different parts of her thinking in terms of the key philosophical approaches, themes, subjects that you would expect to find in any philosopher. So epistemology, this is fundamental to how philosophy is done, particularly in this time. What is our theory of knowledge? That's going to underpin everything we do. The same with her theology, which was pervasive not only in her time but in her thinking. Virtue was a hugely important sort of moral and rational epistemological subject. So these things are very important in building her as a philosopher. Now, once we've done that, we turn to the question of her legacies. And again, the word legacies can be taken in various ways, because in one sense, she has a clear legacy as a pioneering feminist, and everyone has acknowledged her as this. And so her place in the sort of pantheon is assured. But beyond the direct legacy that she's had, and that's something which we can look at in many ways. So Eileen's already mentioned Shelley and Frankenstein. Well, Shelley's debt to her mother is very, very deep. And in many ways, in Frankenstein, but some of her other novels. She's written others that also have very, very clear political, philosophical themes that I think are underexplored by political philosophers. She wrote one about the Italian Renaissance and Machiavelli's time, Valperga. She wrote an apocalyptic novel, The Last Man. Again, these have these Republican themes coming through, and there's virtue and rights and all these kind of ideas. And they're Wollstonecraftian, very, very much so, far more than they are Godwinian in my personal view, which her father was William Godwin. So we can trace her legacy in many ways. But now that we're seeing her as a philosopher in her own right, there is so much potential now to apply her thought in new and novel ways into contemporary debates. And that's what I think many of the chapters do very well in this legacy section. So Elizabeth Fraser writes on democracy. And democracy is somewhat anachronistic for Wollstonecraft. She doesn't use the word. I think Elizabeth mentioned that she used the term only once, democratical, and that's in reply to Burke, who uses it as a kind of slur term. That democracy was at the time often used for chaos and mob rule and vulgarity. Wollstonecraft takes a different view, and we can see the ingredients of what would become democracy in Wollstonecraft. She has an idea of representation, an idea of inclusivity, an idea of secure rights, the notion of what it is to be a citizen, meaningful voice. In other words, making sure that background prejudices and patriarchy don't skew the voice. So you can unpick a proto-democratic sort of ideal from Wollstonecraft, but the way she does it is interesting and novel for contemporary democratic theorists. So she's another source to draw on, and she has for those who are Wollstonecraftian experts, she has a way to speak to contemporary audiences beyond her usual sort of outlets. She can speak into debates on citizenship. So we had an excellent chapter from Melanie White. We had a chapter on human rights. And these are sort of subjects where human rights, other than Eileen's wonderful work on this, you might not necessarily think of Wollstonecraft in terms of human rights. It's a different era. But she has a lot to say about that. And so her legacy can extend almost indefinitely, depending on the questions we now ask. Because once we have a grasp of her philosophy, we can now then speak into contemporary debates, no less than if we were examining Mill or Rousseau or Kant. And it was interesting that Sandrine mentioned Rousseau and Kant as the two books that were coming out at the same time as Wollstonecraft. We have there a nice list of the canonical philosophers. Wollstonecraft, Rousseau, Wollstonecraft, Kant in that nice order. Once she's got a place in that scheme, then I think her legacy can expand. The more questions we have to ask about our contemporary debates, the more we can interrogate her and find inspiration and apply it in a current context. I think it's time for Eileen to have a word.
Yeah, thank you. I agree with Alan that the potential for applying Wollstonecraft's visionary political theory to contemporary debates is vast, and it's really our task now to begin to apply these ideas. One of my favorite chapters in the legacy section is by Lorna Bracewell, a feminist political theorist at Flagler College in the United States. She looks at Wollstonecraft through the lens of contemporary gender theory, including Judith Butler's work. And I think here we have a pioneering new field in both feminist theory and Wollstonecraft studies. I think so much more work needs to be done on the way that Wollstonecraft was surprisingly aware of ideas that we now consider to be revolutionary and avant-garde, including conceptions of transgender identity. There's a well-known passage in Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Woman where she sets forth a kind of thought experiment, you know, and she says, you know, perhaps there are some women who actually have the souls of men inside their bodies. And she means it as a thought experiment. She doesn't mean it literally. But this thought experiment philosophically, I think, anticipates some of the questions we're having today around what it means to be transgender. And I think that going forward, I personally would love to see a younger generation of feminist and gender scholars within political theory and philosophy take up Wollstonecraft as an intriguing philosophical source for some of our contemporary debates.
And so I wanted to then ask the three of you, and I'd said this in our email exchange. You've talked a little bit about some of the things that are going on in terms of the work that contributed to this volume, but what was surprising to you either in your reading of Wollstonecraft as you were working on this project, or to some degree, what was surprising to you when you got a chapter in and you said, oh my God, I'd never thought about thinking about that way. Can you talk a little bit about the surprises in the research? This is a big book. You did a lot of work in terms of recruiting authors and setting out the parameters of the work. I'm just curious as to what was surprising and intriguing as you were pulling the pieces together.
To me, what came as a surprise was the sheer breadth and depth of the existing scholarship on Wollstonecraft, because up till now I'd only really looked at works by philosophers, but Eileen especially introduced us to so many people who'd been working on Wollstonecraft, some of them for a very long time, like Wendy Gunther Canada, for instance, who'd been working with her in teaching, in developing theories, for instance, the chapter on education in Plant 2 by Susan Laird. She clearly has been working on educational theory using Wollstonecraft's work. And that to me was amazing. And the other thing that I found really surprising was how well we managed to get this done on time.
That's very impressive.
We managed to submit a huge manuscript on time, basically, and that I was very impressed by us, and I'm quite surprised that we managed to pull this off.
Yeah, I mean that actually on that it's no mean feat. I've contributed chapters to books that I wrote a year before we started this project, and we're still waiting for those to come out. So my thanks go to the contributors who were actually very good at getting things done and turning it around. I would echo what Sandrine said about the extent of Wollstonecraft studies that perhaps had been done in pockets of academia that we weren't aware of, and that's probably a reflection of our own parochialism and probably Anglocentric parochialism as well. But another thing that struck me that I alluded to earlier was, in some ways, Wollstonecraft is the tip of an iceberg. That the depth that we're finding in her work is exceptional, but it wasn't unique. There are other women that have been less studied that are awaiting a similar kind of recovery and rehabilitation. Catherine McCauley is one. That was my own chapter for this book, so I spent some time looking at her. But she's in a similar position to Wollstonecraft, a huge reputation in her time, extensive network of interlocutors, influence, entirely forgotten until really the early part of this century. But there are others. And in the French context, Sandrine herself has written on Alain de Gouges and several others, Sophie de Grouchy. And there are many more that are also rich, also with networks, also sort of ripe, really, to be rediscovered and reintegrated into our contemporary sort of understanding, not just of the period, not just of what women themselves have contributed, but to the way we understand our disciplines and our kind of political discourses. So, that's exciting times, I think.
Yes. There are so many things about this volume I found surprising. I suppose off the bat, what I found most surprising is when we organized a mini conference at the American Political Science Association in 2017, titled Wallapalooza, I was really struck by the enthusiasm, the excitement in the room. It really, in many ways, I think I said that even then, it was the highlight of my career as a political theorist who's been working on Wollstonecraft since my graduate school years. Just to see people so engaged and interested in Wollstonecraft and her ongoing relevance for political theory, philosophy, and political science. Beyond that, another aspect of the volume that struck me is that we received multiple pitches for some of the most important topics in contemporary political theory and philosophy. We had people competing for the chance to write about Wollstonecraft and the family. To write about Wollstonecraft and religion, to write about Wollstonecraft and democracy, human rights, to write about Wollstonecraft and historical figures, such as John Stuart Mill or Harriet Taylor. And so that was heartening to me because rather than seeing, just two or three people in the field of political science stepping up to the plate, you know, we've mentioned Natalie Taylor, we've mentioned Wendy Gunther Canada, Virginia Shapiro, all political theorists who have been working on Wollstonecraft for quite some time in political science, as well as Daniel O'Neill. All of these scholars contributed to our volume. But it was wonderful to see this array of other scholars, 38 in all, I believe, step up to the plate and try to look at Wollstonecraft on these key issues from new perspectives. There's a lot of debate today whether schools of thought such as liberalism, democracy, human rights still matter anymore. Are we in an age of the death of democracy? Are we in the age of the death of liberalism? Are human rights antiquarian ideas, often subverted and used in ways that are antithetical to their original conception. And it was so heartening to see a legion of scholars step up to the plate and say, Wollstonecraft conceived ideas such as republicanism, liberalism, democracy, and human rights in ways that still speak to urgent concerns of the day.
And I did wanted to ask you about Wallapalooza a little bit, and also the establishment of the Mary Wollstonecraft Society, both of which seem to have come out of this arrangement, this volume itself, but also your interactions with each other. So just briefly, can you explain what Wollapalooza was in just a few more details than you did, and also the establishment of a new sort of society?
So I think Wallapalooza was really Eileen's brainchild. So I'll let her explain it. I'll say a few words about the founding of the society. This actually happened at our first Wallapalooza in San Francisco. And we got together and we said, well, we need to have a society. And we said, well, let's have a society. Here we have, we have a society. And then there was a bit of to and fro with an existing Wollstonecraft society run in London by Bea Rollat and a few other people. And we decided to call it the Mary Wollstonecraft Philosophical Society. And so far we've got a website, and we'd really like to recruit more people to help us manage that website and create a list, etc. And we've started a collaboration with another group in London, so with the Wollstonecraft Society that exists in London, and another group as well that's run by Emma Cleary. And they host a Wollstonecraft celebration, which is now once a year as well in London. And Eileen and Alan have been to the first one. I'm going to be at the second one. So this is all really exciting. We're reaching out into the world thanks to this book, I think. But I think Eileen should talk about Wollapalooza.
Okay, yes, I can speak briefly about that. The term Wollapalooza is obviously inspired by the rock concert Lollapalooza, but the term originated, appropriation of it originated maybe 10 or 15 years ago. I was teaching Wollstonecraft to undergraduates, and I hosted a Wollstonecraft speaker series on campus. And I think Lyndall Gordon's excellent biography of Mary Wollstonecraft, Vindication, A Life of Mary Wollstonecraft, had just come out. So it must have been around 2005 or 2006. And Lyndall came to campus and gave a lecture, and she contributed the chapter on Virginia Woolf to our volume, The Wollstonecraftian Mind. And Lyndall gave such a wonderful lecture. It inspired a real enthusiasm in the students for recovering Wollstonecraft and that for integrating Wollstonecraftian ideas into their everyday life in the way they thought about things like gender and the family and democratic participation. And I was really struck by that. And I wanted to come up with a term to convey to my students this enthusiasm they felt for Wollstonecraft. And I forget exactly when it got coined, but it was, I think, during the visit of Lyndall Gordon to campus. And before long, my students were spreading it about. Back then, it was before Facebook, so it didn't go viral in that sense. But nowadays, thanks to the internet, we're able to spread the message of Wollapalooza all around the world.
I love it. I love it. That's great. I wanted to thank my three interlocutors today, Sandrine Berges, Eileen Hunt-Botting, and Alan Coffey, for joining me to talk about The Wollstonecraftian Mind. This was published by Routledge Press in 2019 and is part of the Routledge Philosophical Minds series. And I assume, I'm going to ask you all, one can buy this at the Routledge website as well as other places online.
Yes, I would love to put a pitch in for all the academics listening. Please order this for your university libraries. It's really a timeless resource. It's the first philosophical compendium on Mary Wollstonecraft. We've had many compendiums that look at Wollstonecraft from literary perspectives, historical perspectives, but this is the first time we've had a true philosophy compendium on Wollstonecraft. So this is a major disciplinary on scholarly importance. And no matter what your field is, whether you're a philosopher or not, I encourage scholars out there who care about Wollstonecraft and her legacies to order a copy for your library.
And this is a gorgeous book. I can't recommend it enough. And it's really, really substantial and interesting and important. So I thank you, the three of you, for joining me today and for putting together this amazing book.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.